was a year ago November. I went out to hunt some deer on a morning bright and clear. I went and shot the maximum the game laws would allow. 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a cow. I was in no mood to trifle. I took down my trusty rifle and went out to stalk my prey. What a haul I made that day. I tied them to my fender and I drove them home somehow. 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a cow. The law was very firm. It took away my permits, the worst punishment I ever endured. It turned out there was a reason. Cows were out of season and one of the hunters wasn't insured. People ask me how I do it, and I say there's nothing to it. You just stand there looking cute, and when something moves, you shoot. And there's 10 stuffed heads in my trophy room right now. 2 game wardens, 7 hunters, and a purebred Guernsey cow.
A young cowboy named Billy Joe grew restless on the farm. A boy filled with wanderlust who really meant no harm. He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot as quick and straight as anybody can. But I wouldn't shoot without a cause. I'd gun nobody down." But she cried again as he rolled away, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He sang a song as on he rode, his guns hung at his hips. He rode into a cattle town, a smile upon his lips. He stopped and walked into a bar and laid his money down. But his mother's words echoed again, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He drank his first strong liquor then to calm his shaking hand and tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to laugh him down, and he heard again his mother's words, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." Bill with rage, then Billy Joe reached for his gun to draw. But the stranger drew his gun and fired before he even saw. As Billy Joe fell to the floor, the crowd all gathered round and wondered at his final words, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town."
Good morning, Marlena Smith here, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band, the electronic salon. I'm here with Eddie G, and we have a special guest we'll be bringing up, James Bamford, author of A Pretext for War, The Puzzle Palace. Eddie?
Yo.
Yo. Oh, Eddie, that was the wrong you.
Am I on now?
You are on now. Sorry.
Oh, cool.
Sorry, I was so excited about Johnny Cash. So what's the relevance of this Johnny Cash?
Well, we started out with Tom Lehrer and the hunting song, which I thought was just perfect. When I just stand there looking cute, and when something moves, I shoot.
Did something happen this week? I heard something about a shooting.
I heard that. Did you know the President of the United States shot somebody in the face?
Was it the President?
Vice President.
The Vice President. Yeah, I think I heard something about that.
Yeah, we heard something about that. And then, of course, Johnny Cash, "Don't take your guns to town." This is advice that, not that Dick Cheney ever heeded. needs any advice from anyone except oil companies, but, you know, he might think about that the next time.
Maybe we could send him a copy of Johnny Cash.
He wouldn't listen to it.
Okay. I just want to remind our listeners, I have James Bamford on the line, so I don't want to be too long here. A couple of points of information. We'll be talking to him for the next hour. Then I'm going to be talking to Peter Emerson, an interesting man here in the community who's opened a little cafe called the Bipartisan Cafe. My fantasy has come true. There's really a cafe that's got mixed politics and even gathers together around coffee on election night. And then we're going to get back to Dave Emery, who's done a compilation of some of the older, more important anti-fascist texts that are going to be available free on Spitfire, so we'll talk to him. And, of course, astrologically, we'll be moving out of air into water tomorrow, so everything will become less intellectual and more emotional. Let's bring up James Bamford. Hi, James.
Hi.
How you doing?
Oh, very good.
Okay, and you said I could call you Jim.
Yeah, Jim's fine.
Hey, Eddie, want to say hi to Jim?
Mr. Bamford, Jim, it's good to talk to you again. I spoke to you in Portland when you were coming through, not for a pretext for war, but the last book before that. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good talking to you, Eddie.
Jim, let me just tell our listeners a little bit about you. Recent news of Bush administration eavesdropping of the domestic population has highlighted fears of a government no longer in touch with the Bill of Rights. Elements within the United States Congress have challenged this practice, and the Senate Intelligence Committee has held open and closed meetings with the Attorney General to attempt to gain some understanding of the dimensions of the problem. On the most, one of the most stunning moments of questioning with Attorney General Gonzalez was his response that, electronic surveillance has been done since our first president, George Washington. If this didn't send shivers down our backs, then we are indeed asleep. For it revealed the failure of this administration to have not only a rational team in place, but as well an intellectually rigorous and ethical policy. In question, of course, is the National Security Agency, the most secret intelligence organization in the United States. And, of course, as you already know, with us today is Mr. James Bamford, who is an expert on the NSA, the spying scandal, and the whole concept of perception management done by the Rendon Corporation. And James Bamford has also written not only The Pretext for War, his most recent book, but The Puzzle Palace and Body of Secrets. He also writes for the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post Magazine, the Los Angeles Times Magazine. He has also been the Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with the late Peter Jennings. And he is a distinguished visiting professor at UCal Berkeley. And once again, Jim Bamford, welcome back to KBOO.
Well, thanks, Maya.
Okay, I want to bring you up so we can actually hear you. I want to thank you for giving us your time this morning, and again, you know that Eddie and I will be talking to you together, and so maybe the first question is, what is your background and what got you interested in the NSA?
Well, I was in law school, and I didn't really have any desire to practice law. I wanted to write, and I was always very interested in the intelligence community. There have been dozens of books written on the CIA, but nobody had ever written a book on NSA, so it was a really interesting challenge since there have been not only no books, but almost no articles ever written on it. So I spent 3 years looking into it, and that's how I did the Puzzle Palace, and since then, that came out in 82. Since then, I've followed the agency very closely, and I was with Peter Jennings for about 10 years as the investigative reporter in Washington, and I covered intelligence community for ABC and for a number of other publications.
Mm-hmm. Eddie?
We have a Rolling Stone article that you wrote, looking at the date on this thing.
December 1st.
Yeah, it's got Madonna on the cover, so you can't miss it. But this talks about a group called the Rendon Group and their effect on the war in Iraq and why the war in Iraq would have been impossible without them. The first question I have is about this guy named Al-Haidari, who apparently took a polygraph in 2001 and failed it. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the Rendon Group basically created this organization known as the Iraqi National Congress, the INC, run by Ahmed Chalabi. And throughout the entire 1990s, together with a number of the neoconservatives in Washington, they pushed very hard to get a war going where the United States would invade Iraq, and they finally succeeded. Well, as they were doing this pushing, especially in the time period after September 11th. They began the INC and Chalabi and so forth, and some of the ex-Rendon people began coming up with these defectors that they found from Iraq. And these defectors were telling these stories about eyewitness accounts of Iraq having all this weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical, nuclear weapons, and so forth. And none of it was true, but they, you know, they wanted to get the United States involved in this war, and the best way was to try to publicize the threat of Iraq. And one of the people that they came up with was this person by the name of Al-Hadary, and he was an Iraqi who wanted to leave Iraq and wanted to go to Australia, but he couldn't get a visa. He flew to Bangkok, and the INC people actually helped him out of Iraq to Bangkok, and they were trying to help him get a visa. But it was sort of a quid pro quo, I guess, because the INC people decided to use him as a vehicle to help create this sort of fear-mongering in the U.S. towards Iraq. And what they did was they called up two of their favorite journalists. One of them was Judy Miller of the New York Times, who'd done numerous favorable stories about Chalabi and the INC. And they gave her worldwide print exclusive rights to interview this guy. Then they gave the other worldwide television rights to another person by the name of Paul Moran from Australian television. So you have these two people. Both of them were extremely favorably inclined towards doing this story, because Judy Miller had a long relationship with the INC doing favorable stories, and Paul Moran was even worse, because he formerly worked for the INC and formerly worked for the Rendon Corporation, Rendon Group. So they put out this story. Judy Miller did a front page story in the New York Times. It appeared around December 20th, 2001. It was really the first story to really push the American public a long ways towards the war, because before the story there was just speculation of what Saddam Hussein might have. But Judy Miller did a front page story based on the false claims of this defector that Saddam had chemical, biological, nuclear weapons, that this defector had helped bury the weapons and was an eyewitness to Saddam having it. And again, this is the worst form of journalism, because here she is going with a defector she meets once, had no confirmation from anybody else, knowing that defectors almost inevitably make things up and exaggerate things. Yet they went with a front page story on this interview with the defector, and then Paul Moran broadcast a long interview with the defector for Australian television, and that got picked up by television networks all over the world. So this was the first sort of media blast at the using false information to get the U.S. into war.
Jim, wouldn't it be pretty tough for the New York Times, and I'm not trying to give them any kudos here, but wouldn't it be pretty tough to fact-check the story like this? I mean, we've got intelligence people, we've got faked polygraph tests, etc. How would any media corporation actually fact-check something like this or be more cautious?
Well, I was with ABC for 10 years. If I had come in there during the Cold War and said, I have a Russian defector I just met, spent an hour with, don't know where he came from, don't know where he's going, but I spent an hour with this guy, and he tells me that Russia has all kinds of biological weapons hidden all over the place. They'd say, that's a nice start, now go back and start doing some reporting.
Okay.
In other words, asking other people, finding out what the U.S. thought about it, what is the guy's background, where is he coming from, what credibility does he have. You know, that's a starting point, certainly not an ending point.
Okay, so Floyd Abrams has a tough road ahead of him. The attorney for Judy Miller.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she got a lot of bad press for her reporting, and, you know, she deserves it with bad reporting. And the problem is, when you, it's not just bad reporting on, you know, a a highway project. This is a bad reporting that helped get the United States into a war.
Exactly. Now, you talked about the Rendon Group, and that's what we're discussing right now from the article that was in Rolling Stone December 1st of 2005. You are, of course, James Bamford. Excuse me. You talk about this Rendon Group. Let's talk a little bit about who the lead person is, some of his flip-flops, and what is this whole concept of perception management? How did the government come to be involved in using him to promote war? And, in fact, for the last 20 years, according to your article, he's been at the forefront of generating the proper media for war, which I find interesting because everybody talks about how timid the media is, and yet here's this guy being paid big bucks to make sure that the media stays timid.
Well, he's a John Rendon's a very interesting person. He'd never given an interview before I spoke to him, and he's this very mysterious person in Washington. He's always a number of people have heard of John Rendon, but few people have ever met him or talked to him. And he has a very interesting, at least recently, because he has a very interesting background. He started off in the early 70s as a anti-Vietnam War activist. He was very active in the McGovern campaign, a peace campaign, basically. He was the coordinator for the state of Maine, and he rose very quickly in Democratic politics. He quickly became the executive director of the Democratic National Party in Washington. He became very close to Jimmy Carter and helped run Jimmy Carter's campaign. But everything changed when Carter lost in 1980, and then Rendon had to go off on his own when Reagan took over and the Democrats were out. He went off on his own. He began his own public relations firm, and he started getting foreign contracts with foreign governments that were looking to have somebody help them with their prepare for their elections and so forth. And that led to around 1989 the CIA getting in touch with Rendon to have him be their man to help get an opposition figure to Noriega down in Panama elected. The CIA wanted to overthrow Panama, overthrow Noriega in the same way they wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And they went down there and they ousted Noriega. And at the same time, for a year before that, as they were planning this, Rendon was taking the candidate that the CIA wanted in place instead of Noriega. And he took him around Europe and introduced him to senior government officials over there and heads of state and the Pope, and had photo ops with these people in order to take this person who was basically just a local lawyer in Panama and make him look like a world-class figure. And then when Noriega attacked Indira, that's the person that Rendon was trying to get publicity for, when Indira was attacked by Noriega and became very bloodied, some of his supporters became bloodied, Rendon made sure that that picture went around the world, and it became the front page, or the cover picture on Time magazine. So when the U.S. finally did invade, Rendon was on one of the very first planes into Panama to help put Indira into place after the overthrow of Noriega. And from there, he went on to Kuwait, where he helped the Kuwaiti government demonize the Saddam regime and make their government look very very good, because at the time they wanted U.S. support to oust Saddam. So he went over there to help the Kuwaiti government, and among the things he did was he wanted to make there was some bad press, for example, when a lot of the senior and very wealthy Kuwaitis went to Saudi Arabia and Egypt and were just sort of living it up at luxury resorts while the U.S. was fighting the battle. That was getting some bad publicity, so Rendon had shipped over thousands and thousands of valentines and to Kuwait, and he had Kuwaiti people sign these valentines and send them to military people, and then got a lot of publicity for that to make it look like the Kuwaitis were very grateful and so forth for all the help. And then when the war was won, he had a lot of flags flown over so it would the march would look like the victory in Paris after World War II. The whole thing was what was known as perception management. In other words, manage the public's perception of what was going on. It's sort of an advanced form of public relations. And after Kuwait, the CIA, which had a long relationship with Rudin, hired him to basically do a similar thing as he did in Panama, create an opposition force to Saddam Hussein, and that's when he helped create the INC, the Iraqi National Congress, and helped put Ahmad Chalabi in office in power as the head of the organization. Then he funneled about $350,000, about $350,000 a month to the INC from the CIA. So he's acting as both a conduit for the CIA and also as he told me, the senior advisor to the INC. And throughout the 1990s, the one goal of the INC was to get the United States one way or another, through publicity, through pressure, through lobbying, to launch a war against Saddam Hussein, and then eventually, Chalabi hoped, he would become the president. And that was what the neocons were all pushing for not only for the war, but then also for Chalabi to become head of the new Iraqi government.
Jim?
Yeah.
This Chalabi guy, now, is it in Lebanon or Jordan, where he's a fugitive from justice? This guy, why would anybody trust this guy? He was a proven liar. He had some personal issues. Besides the fact that he was a fugitive from justice, why him?
Wouldn't that make him actually more desirable?
I don't know.
Sorry?
Would it make him more desirable because they've got so much on him?
Well, he is a fugitive from justice from Jordan, where he's accused of embezzling millions of dollars, and a lot of people didn't trust him. The CIA began mistrusting him in the mid 90s, and after that, they basically declared him a fabricator. And that's when Chalabi started getting very cozy with the people in the Pentagon. And so, although both the State Department and the CIA basically declared him persona non grata, he was adopted by the Pentagon, and the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, began listening to all these defectors and so forth, and the Pentagon, especially Doug Fife, who was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, began, and also Paul Wolfowitz, who was the number two in the Pentagon, began pushing and pushing to get Chalabi, not only to get the war, but then to get Chalabi in there as president. That's why they had this huge parade for Chalabi in Iraq, a huge parade that nobody paid any attention to because nobody knew who he was.
You also note in this article, and I want to remind our listeners, you are James Bamford. We're talking about an article you wrote for Rolling Stone December 1st, 2005, about the Rendon Corp group, which is the group that has done the primary media worldwide for the last 20 years, and in particular for the Iraq conflict that we're involved in now. There is a question about the legal status of the government using its own propaganda at home. Where does this story fit in that legal question?
Well, there is a law on the books that prohibits the U.S. government from propagandizing its own public. But it can use organizations like the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and other organizations to push the government's word out to other people. The problem that exists today is you have groups like the Rendon group, which is just one of a number of organizations the government uses to propagandize around the world. Another one is the Lincoln Group, which is sort of a smaller version of the Rendon Group. And these groups have gotten these contracts from the Pentagon to push propaganda around the world in various places. The Lincoln Group, for example, was paying newspapers in Iraq to print stories that were written by actually the U.S. military. A really pure form of propaganda. Now, all that would be illegal in the United States, but the problem is today, where you have instant communications and where the entire world is sort of wrapped in the same ball of electrons, once a story appears in Baghdad or Kabul or in the Persian Gulf, anywhere in the world, it immediately gets picked up in the U.S. press. So there's almost no difference. If you want to plant a story in the United States press, it's just as easy to plant it overseas, and then, within a microsecond, it'll be on somebody's computer or somebody's web page or else in somebody's newspaper in the United States.
And you do point out that the scope of this Rendon Group is 195 newspapers, 43 nations, 14 to 15 languages every day.
Well, that's what they... part of what Rendon's contract with the Pentagon is to analyze this information and report to the Pentagon and give them a heads up on news all over the world. And it gives the people in the Pentagon time to come up with a quick response or, put their own story out there someplace in some newspaper to counteract it.
Now, you also note that Rendon got paid something like $326,000 a month, or still does. And there's also some information in your article in Rolling Stone, December 1st, the Office of Strategic Influence, that information had shifted from the CIA to the Pentagon. Is this part of where we begin to see this tension between this administration and elements of the CIA?
Well, the CIA was, their job was mostly collecting intelligence overseas, but then the Pentagon began putting an enormous effort into propagandizing, doing two things. One is pushing stories around the world, and the other one was to dig through information around the world, do sort of data mining for the Pentagon around the world. And that was what the Office of Strategic Influence was trying to do, was to get the Pentagon's message sometimes secretly planted in news organizations around the world. They were trying to counteract the enormous amount of distrust and hate for the United States that was being engendered by their foreign policy programs, such as the war in Iraq and so forth.
When the CIA dumped Rendon and the Pentagon picked him up, they had their program, this OSI program, which was about planting false news items. It was covert disinformation and deception. That got shut down, and something called the Information Operations Task Force was set up inside the Pentagon. And then they rehired Rendon. And one of the things that Rendon had was something called LiveWire software, which apparently could, that's your data mining thing. It went around the world and it would get these stories off the wire sometimes before they appeared on air or in the blogs. But one of the things that IOTF did was target Al Jazeera because they disliked the influence of Al Jazeera, and targeted foreign journalists. The ones that had favorable stories, they promoted, and the ones that were unfavorable, they undermined in some way. Can you talk about the IOTF?
Yeah, they were very, very worried about Al Jazeera, and they asked the Rendon Group, the Pentagon asked the Rendon Group to basically build up dossiers on all the different reporters. And there was a lot of worry that, this would be used to intimidate the reporters into not reporting what they were normally reporting, and to report instead favorable stories towards the United States. So it was the first case I've seen where the Pentagon's actually hired a company to go out and build basically dossiers on foreign reporters. And then Renan would turn those over to the Pentagon. And then you know, you don't know what would happen after that. I mean, Renan Group wouldn't be involved in anything in terms of necessarily intimidation or anything, but that would, once the information was turned over to the Pentagon, then who knows what the Pentagon or the CIA would do after that.
Now, Rendon is essentially doing data mining himself, collecting data from everywhere. Is there infiltration of, you know, alternative media, the Democratic Party candidates, et cetera? Is there any evidence of that?
Well, the problem that you have with this is that this is all sort of brand new with this administration, and you have two sort of a perfect storm there. You have the, on the one hand, the administration getting enormously heavily involved in data mining and finding sources of information in the United States covertly, getting people's telephone records, credit card records, all kinds of things, and at the same time, you have a dearth of law out there. There's very little law that protects people from this whole idea of data mining, where the government's basically buying all this information from private industry. So you have a dearth of laws to protect people from that, and then at the same time, the laws that are on the books, such as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, to prevent NSA from eavesdropping on all these people, you have the government, you know, openly flaunting it, going around it, violating it, and so it's a, like I said, it's sort of a perfect storm. On the one hand, you have a government with the ability and the desire to dig through as many electronic files as possible, which are medical files, financial files, you know, credit card files, any kind of files that are kept on people, and at the same time, possibly sharing all that with NSA, that has a huge ability to eavesdrop on people secretly all over the country.
And there was also, Rendon was really, really clever about this. Not only did they create teams of people to go around the world to various countries and produce news pieces that may or may not have had any basis in fact, but were just favorable to the United States effort in Iraq, but they also created a website so they could invade the blogosphere as well. And they had disinformation on this website in like four or five languages, in English, Arabic, who knows what, I guess Afghan. And they use this also as a tool for people who get their news off the web.
Right. That was in Rendon's contract, that he was supposed to create these websites and so forth. And, you know, so it makes it very confusing out there today. When you're reading something, you don't know if it's coming, if this is really the product of a group of people who have these unified beliefs, or whether this is just the product of somebody sitting in the basement of the Pentagon cooking all this stuff up. And that's the problem. You've got a Pentagon today with a great desire to try to fabricate information, basically, to get the public thinking, not that they're doing these invasions and so forth for the reasons that they're saying, but for completely different reasons.
Any advice to people listening on how to sort out information?
Well, it's very, very difficult, especially if you're dealing with the information that's coming from overseas, because you don't know whether that information originated from the actual overseas source, or the overseas source got it somehow covertly, or was paid to take it, or it was planted with them by the Pentagon. So it's, I don't know if there is any way of doing that. It's just that every now and then there'll be a whistleblower, or somebody from the news organizations will stumble across a case like either the Rendon Group or the Lincoln Group or one of these other organizations. So it's I think it's just the tip of the iceberg. I think what only what we're able to see here, Running Group, Lincoln Group, the Information Operations Task Force, and all these other groups, are just sort of the tip of a much bigger iceberg that we don't see.
Is there anything in your own mind or your own sensibility, having interviewed James Rendon, about where he is now? What's going on in his head? Does he really believe in this work? Does he just pretend to believe in it? I mean, is he stuck as though he were in the mob or something? I mean, where's this cat now?
Well, I mean, Rendon's a very, you know, charming person. I mean, person that ran, went from sort of anti-war activist in the early 70s to quickly become the head of the Democratic Party. So he's able to, you know, he's very nice person to talk to and deal with. But, you know, since he's completely switched his at least his political standing from anti-war to sort of pushing wars, he justifies it largely by saying that, you know, what he's doing is supporting the troops. We're at war, the troops are over there, they're fighting, and it's his job to help support them in any way, and he feels that by providing his information operations activities on behalf of the Pentagon, he's, you know, this is a very patriotic thing to do, and
that's incredibly,
the troops and all that.
That's incredibly ironic.
Well, it is. It's that's why I thought it was a very interesting story, that a person would go from, you know, fighting the Vietnam War politically, doing everything he could politically, and trying to help get, you know, the anti-war candidate, George McGovern, elected, and rising to head the Democratic Party, and close to Jimmy Carter, who was, you know, far from being a warmonger, to now being the Pentagon's man on the this Republican war in Iraq. So it is this enormous sea change.
You know, I wonder if we could shift gears a little bit and talk about your book, Pretext for War. I want to let our listeners know you are James Bamford we're talking to. We've been discussing a Rolling Stones article about the Rendon Corporation, which is the White House, really the paid, the hired gun to do the promotion and propaganda for the wars, for the war in Iraq, and has done, this guy has done this for the last 20 years. But in your book, A Pretext for War, which came out in 2005, this is, first of all, a chilling book, Jim. Opening the first page and realizing I was beginning to read the entire saga of 9-1-1, a terrifying story. Can you tell our listeners in some kind of sketch form, you know, really what was going on that day and versus what we thought might be going on?
You're talking about on the morning of 9/11.
Yeah, where was the president? Where was the vice president? Where was Rumsfeld? Where was George Tenet? Meanwhile, where was the NSA? Why wasn't the NSA on top of this? Because they're supposed to be the guys who know this stuff. I mean, what kind of happened that allowed that to occur?
Well, this was a very leisurely day when it started out for the U.S. government. The president was down there in Florida, Sarasota, Florida, pushing for votes. He was down there just having, he spent the night of September 10th down there. And he was down there with his brother having some sort of minor photo ops. He was going to go to a school and meet with some children and to help push his education plan. In Washington, George Tenet, since he didn't have to brief the president that morning, decided to take it easy. And he, George Tenet was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. So he went to have sort of a leisurely breakfast with one of his friends, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and so they were just having a leisurely breakfast. People in Congress and the Pentagon were not alerted to anything. I mean, this was a very quiet, mundane day. And the first indications came when I think it was United Airlines, either United or American Airlines, got the first indication that one of their planes were being hijacked.
Just may I interrupt for just a minute? Weren't there also war games going on that week that completely threw everybody off?
Well, there was a the Air National Guard, NORAD people, the North American Air Defense Command people, were having an alert. They do this every once in a while, or a few months, or whatever. Have a practice alert to see what's happening. To see, you know, how fast they could react and so forth. So that was going on that morning. And so after the first plane was hijacked, there was a message sent from the airline to basically to NORAD saying, we have a plane that's hijacked. We can't, we're not sure what's happening with it. And from that moment on, that's when things started moving behind the scenes. And as more indications came into NORAD that there was other planes being hijacked, they started scrambling some of the jets that they had. The problem was that this is a post-Cold War period. There was only, I think it was either 12 or 14 jets in the entire United States that were on the ready in case of an attack. And they were in places that were not really close to the major metropolitan areas. So even though it looked like these planes were heading towards New York, the commercial planes that were being hijacked, the closest that NORAD had anybody was a base on Cape Cod, Otis Air Force Base. So and then when they found planes heading towards Washington, the closest they had aircraft was down in the Norfolk, Virginia area. So neither of those planes, once they were finally scrambled, were anywhere close to the planes when they actually struck the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. So NORAD was caught completely by surprise on this whole thing. One of the very ironic things here, the U.S. has this very elaborate and very sophisticated early warning system. A lot of it is being run by NSA. And it's a place called DEFSMAC, which stands for Defense Special Missile and Astronautics Center. They watch for early warnings of a missile attack. And it's a very expensive operation using satellites and everything. And in their office at NSA, they sat there and they watched the attack take place on a $300 television. So even though we had all this infrastructure in place to supposedly protect ourselves from an attack, it was everybody was caught completely by surprise.
Jim
and George Tenet was actually. Found out about it probably minutes later than people, sitting at home watching television, eating a bowl of cereal, because it took them a while to actually tell him about it.
Jim, a question that's been rolling around since September 11th, which has never been answered to my satisfaction, isn't the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, an airplane has something called a transponder? When these guys hijacked the planes, they turned off the transponders. If a commercial jet loses its transponder, isn't a bunch of things supposed to happen? Or isn't there a procedures and protocols that are supposed to ensue from that that didn't happen on September 11th? Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, they did turn off the transponder, but there is another... I think that sort of eliminates the FAA at that point, but it doesn't eliminate the... because the FAA, I think, is receiving the passive signal, but there is also radar. It's possibly the FAA has it, but I know that the military has it. So they were able to follow some of these planes, even though the transponder was turned off. It's just that they didn't know necessarily which plane was which, and they didn't have much of a much more information that there was a plane out there flying without a transponder on.
Uh-huh. Well, the question is, if it happens to one plane, you might say it's an equipment failure. If it happens to four planes, and these planes are going off their prescribed path, then you got to think something's going on. What went on?
Sure, yeah. Well, they also had other indications. I think there was either a microphone left open or it was deliberately one of the hijackers in one of the planes deliberately spoke. But whatever the case, the information that what the hijackers in the cockpit were saying was being broadcast for at least a short period of time to one of the control towers. And he talked about we have planes and so forth. So it was clear that they were talking about more than one plane at that time. And if, you know, at the same time they had all these planes switch off their transponder, and I don't think it would have taken a lot of genius to figure that this was a conspiracy, that there was more than one plane involved.
You also, oh, I'm sorry, Eddie.
No, this was strictly the fact that there were enough airplanes scrambled within close enough distance to affect the situation. Is that the bottom line on this?
Well, that was, then the other question is, what do they do once they are scrambled? I mean, if they got up to the plane, what are they going to do? They certainly couldn't shoot it down.
Well, don't we have a protocol about that?
I'm sorry?
Don't we have a protocol about that? If a plane is hijacked and they feel like it might be used as a missile, isn't there a protocol set up for that?
Well, there is now, but there wasn't then.
Uh-huh.
And again, we're talking about it, the early stages here. Before the planes hit, all three planes hit, within very short, within an hour, basically, of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, when this thing first happened and they were able to scramble those planes, they weren't able to get close enough to the commercial airliners. The scrambled jets, Air Force jets, weren't able to get close. But even if they were, there's nothing they could have done. What are they going to do? Shoot the plane down?
Well, yeah.
They had no idea that they were going to crash into the World Trade Center until that happened.
Uh-huh.
The final plane, the one that eventually crashed into Pennsylvania, that was the one that they gave the order on, because that one was much slower, much later than the others, and that was the one they gave the order on to shoot down if they could, but the others, there wasn't time to give the order on those.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a curious coincidence that we have the Joint Chiefs out of the country. Rumsfeld is actually on his way to the Pentagon, according to your book, Pretext for War, to lambaste the Pentagon as an out-of-touch threat to the American public, blah, blah, blah. He's blaming the bureaucracy at the Pentagon for all sorts of things. Tenet's having breakfast with somebody, I think, Bourne, former intelligence committee chair in the Senate. And Mr. Bush, of course, is somewhere down in Florida. Can you tell us a little bit about Mr. Bush and that kind of sequence of events of what he knew, when he knew it, and what his response was?
Sure, yeah. That was one of the sort of oddest things of that day, was that Bush was down there to give this little photo op in this, I think it was second grade classroom with about a dozen students in there. And now his account that he's said numerous times and that was actually on the White House website was that he arrived at the school. They told him immediately that there was some kind of a problem with hijacking. They brought him into this little room. They had a TV set on. He looked over the TV set and he saw the plane crash into the World Trade Center, and then he went in to do the class, and it's very bizarre because there was no video of the first plane hitting the World Trade Center. That didn't come about until much later that day or the next day, because it was filmed from the ground by some French journalists or some French documentary makers. So he couldn't have seen the first plane hit the World Trade Center. And if he did see a plane on the television hit the World Trade Center, which happened, just a few minutes later, what he would have seen was the second plane hit the World Trade Center, which raises a serious question. If you see that both trade centers were attacked by two planes, then there's no question in anybody's mind, pretty much, that that was a deliberate, that this is a deliberate attack. And if that's the case, then why are you going to go into a classroom, you know, to chat with some third graders or second graders, instead of, you know, calling up the armed forces and the Secretary of Defense and finding out what's going on. And then secondly, when he did get into the classroom, and finally he was told that a second plane hit the World Trade Center, and the chief of staff at that point, I mean, actually said the words that we're under attack. The president continued to sit there for a full 7 minutes without doing anything. Could you imagine? I mean, any other president, whether it's you know, FDR, Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, anybody who is told that the U.S. is under attack, the World Trade Center buildings have just been pretty much blown up, and just sit there for 7 minutes instead of immediately saying, I've got an emergency, I have to leave the classroom, and then getting in touch with Secretary of Defense, National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, finding out what the status of NORAD is, what our defenses are, talking to the Director of Central Intelligence to find out what intelligence we have on that. I mean, that would be the normal thing to do if you're president and somebody just tells you the country's under attack.
Can we back up a little bit? You said he made a remark about something about seeing the first plane. Was that what you said?
That's what he said in a number of speeches, and that's what...
And yet you also said that that video wasn't available until later that day, so he couldn't possibly have seen the first one.
No, nobody saw the first one until later that day.
But he said...
He saw the aftermath. I mean, they had cameras up there immediately afterwards,
right,
showing the smoke coming out.
Right.
But nobody had a camera at that moment. Well, there was somebody with a camera at that moment, but that was a film camera down below. And they, you know, they certainly didn't get it out within minutes. It took them a while to get that out. So nobody did see the first plane hit the World Trade Center until, you know, later on, at least later on that day.
Well, what do we make of his remarks then? Just that
I don't know what to make out of it, except, again, like I said, it could have been that he saw the second plane hit instead of the first one, because that one people did see immediately, and it was right around that time, around 9 o'clock. But at that point, what you're seeing on television is both towers on fire at that point, both towers having been attacked. And if that's the case, then it makes you doubly wonder about, you know, his priorities, where he sees the two largest buildings in the country just attacked by what was obviously a terrorist attack. And instead of looking into it or trying to immediately fly back to Washington or you know, take some action of some sort, he walks into a classroom to begin reading a second grade a reader to a half dozen kids in a little schoolroom.
And once again, the irony is that he presents himself as the leader of the party that's strong on defense. Amazing. Eddie?
Yeah, Jim, one quick thing. A caller asked us, what about Andrews Air Force Base? That's a lot closer than Norfolk.
Well, I agree, but they didn't have any planes there. I mean, they had planes there, but they weren't what they call ready planes.
Yeah.
Or on alert planes. They
yeah.
were planes that didn't have any armament on it, and they didn't have people that were ready to be scrambled.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of planes there, but they didn't have any planes that were either armed and ready or crews that were ready to jump in and take off.
One more thing. There was a Washington Post article this past Wednesday by Charles Babington, the title of which is Congressional Probe of NSA Spying is in Doubt. And one of the things that the article indicates is that Olympia Snow, the Republican of Maine, who is definitely a moderate, considered a moderate, and was gung-ho for an investigation of the NSA by Congress, they got to her. And she's now waffling about whether or not she's going to give her support to an NSA investigation. Rockefeller, the Democrat from West Virginia, is all up in arms about this thing. But apparently there's a full court press on by the White House and the Senate. Do you know anything about that?
Well, they've been doing this for a couple weeks now. They've had, they've trotted out everybody they could think of to talk about all the reasons why they should do it. I mean, it's been 2 weeks of sort of massive fear-mongering. The the chant has been, the terrorists are coming, the terrorists are coming, we've got to do this to protect ourselves from terrorists. I think if you look at the Bush's last speech there, I think one out of every four words was either terrorist or terror or whatever. And so the idea here was to get the message across to people that they've got to fear terrorism, and that's why the administration is doing this. And when you don't get an outcry from the public, when the public is, you know, either wishy-washy or 50% one way or the other, or even as it's showing sometimes, in favor of the government doing this, Congress is, you know, the worst leaders in the world. All they ever do is follow, so that's, I think that's the reason, is they're looking at this as a sticking their finger in the air and finding out whether this is a very important political issue for them, and they find their Republican base is not objecting to it. So you get people like Senator Snow, who you know, refuse to be a leader and instead to be a follower, and so they're going to allow a illegal program to go on because they feel it's politically to their advantage.
I have a quick question, or actually two. I don't know how much longer we can keep you, James, and I want to remind our listeners, you are James Banford. We're talking about your book, A Pretext for War. We're talking about a recent article you did for Rolling Stone, December 1, about the Rendon Group that's been doing the propaganda, advertising, PR, whatever you want to call it, for this administration's wars. The whole story about the NSA, the loss of resources, the falling into kind of disrepair, the end of echelon, the satellite-based surveillance technology, as opposed to the intense growth of fiber optics underground, and how that became the new way of doing surveillance. That was all happening just as this administration was coming into power. I'm wondering in my own mind if this NSA spying scandal is part of a trade-off that was made in order to give NSA the money that it needed to reorganize and come into the modern era, and in exchange for that, the deal was you're going to start spying on U.S. citizens.
Well, I think they, I mean, they were given huge amounts of money, as soon as 9/11 happened. There was just, the intelligence community was just literally flooded with money at that point. And, but I think what actually happened was that, General Hayden, who was head of NSA, they were called into meetings and everybody had to contribute. What can you do? What can you, how can you change things to make things, more, able for us to get these terrorists and so forth. And I mean, my belief is that he came up with the idea of doing this, and then he, you know, sort of put the ball in the administration's court, saying, "Well, we could do this, but you know, it's not necessarily going to be legal."
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that point he was hoping that the administration would change the law so that it would make it legal. And my belief is that he tried to get Senator DeWine to pass a bill to that effect, but the administration didn't want to do that, and they instead figure they just instead of trying to change the law, they just break the law.
Mm-hmm.
And go around it, and that's what's happened. And then, you know, Hayden, being a good soldier, saluted and continued to do it, even mm-hmm. though it's illegal.
And then,
Then, of course, the
FISA court, the times when they didn't go, the handful of times when they didn't go to the FISA court, do we know anything more about what those were all about? Some people are talking about
the times that they did go to the FISA court?
No, the times that they didn't go, that they don't want to.
Well, there were more than a handful. I mean,
right.
There's lots of times they didn't go.
Okay, and there are questions about, was that a Democratic Party infiltration? Is there any information that anyone's aware of right now about what those were?
Well, what they did basically was they, instead of going to a FISA court judge and arguing that there was probable cause that an American's involved, they lowered the standard to reasonable belief and avoided the court. So the last report I saw in the Washington Post, they added up to about 5,000 people that have been targeted by NSA illegally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a program that continues to grow, and it's totally illegal. I mean, this is a criminal statute. It's calls for 5 years in jail for anybody who violates it.
And they're all guilty.
And you know, as long as the public is not going to be outraged about it, the Congress is not going to be outraged about it, and there's nothing going to be done about it, probably.
I need to remind our listeners, it's 1 minute after the hour of 10. This is KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7. James, I appreciate your time. If we've got just a couple more minutes, Eddie may have some final questions. I have one final one. What did we want from Iraq? Why are we there?
Well, I think the administration had wanted to go into Iraq for a long time. The neoconservatives, that was part of their number one on their agenda. They wanted to remake the Middle East into their own image, an image of democratic states all over the Middle East. It was very unrealistic. They spent their entire life in these little think tanks, never really getting out in the real world. None of them ever became part of the military. And so they thought this would be a very easy pushover. We go in there, take over Iraq, everybody will throw flowers in our path, and we'll put Ahmad Chalabi in there as president, and then we'll move on to Iran, Syria, you know, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, wherever. And I think that was their plan, and it was unreal. You know, anybody that had any real common sense would have said that the plan was unrealistic in the first place, and many people did. And now they're, you know, thousands of people are paying the price because of their mistake.
Jim, in my shorter memory, maybe than some, this is the worst abuse of these kinds of powers, of using intelligence, of using the military, maybe since J. Edgar Hoover used his own files to advance his own personal agenda. Just, you know, this is a kind of a how high is up question, but have you ever seen anything like this? Is this the worst it's ever been?
Well, yeah, it's definitely the worst it's ever been. I wrote about the this similar things happening during the 60s and 70s when they went after anti-war protesters, and NSA began eavesdropping on journalists and anti-war protesters and so forth. The difference was, in those days, there really wasn't a law. It was sort of this gray area in terms of NSA eavesdropping on U.S. citizens. But today, and then when it was discovered, it was ended, and they created reforms like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. But today, this is the first time I've ever seen an administration actually blatantly violate a law that's on the books, a law that was put there to prevent exactly this from happening. And not only having done it, but to continue to do it in the face of the fact that this is a criminal statute saying you can't do it, and then so weak reaction by both the American public and the Congress.
Jane, is there? Oh, I'm sorry, Eddie.
No. Just reacting.
Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to say, James Bamford, that we haven't asked, or Eddie? Is there anything else you'd like to ask?
No, I'm willing to let Jim go with something he'd like to tell us.
Yeah, Jim, anything?
Well,
that
no,
you'd
I,
like
we,
our
we
listeners
pretty
to
much
hear?
We pretty much covered all the topics. It's just that I think the one thing that the public has very little, you know, public pays very little attention to intelligence activities as it is, and I think when they think of what's going on in terms of NSA's eavesdropping, and the press sort of encourages this, they think in terms of wiretapping. I mean, wiretapping is not what NSA does. It doesn't go around and climb up a telephone pole and put a little alligator clip on somebody's telephone line. What it does is it intercepts millions and millions of communications an hour. Everything that's coming in, going out, or and to a large degree going through the country, and it filters it through these huge computers. So when we're talking about somebody, a name coming up, somebody's name, you know, innocent person perhaps, that name will go into a computer. It's not that somebody's going to climb up a telephone pole outside the person's house. That name will go into a computer. And so anything that involves that person, whether it's a cell phone, an email message, or whatever, will be picked up by it. And, you know, there's not an immediate reaction, like if you're grabbed by some local police officer and put in jail, you know, you immediately see the bars and you immediately feel that what's wrong if you're innocent. In this case, you won't know for months, perhaps years, because your name goes in there and it never comes out. So you know, maybe a few months from now you go to the airport and you're turned down from getting on a plane because you're on the, you know, you're among the 20,000 people or whatever that are on the do not fly list. You go try to get a Small Business Administration loan and you get turned down, and nobody will tell you why, but it's because your name's on the blacklist, this potential terrorist list. Or you fly to London and you can't go in. The customs turn you back because NSA shares all its information with Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. So all these things could happen. It's not as though, oh, I don't care. I don't do anything wrong. I don't mind if they're listening to my phone, which is sort of the simpleton approach to the whole thing. It's much deeper than that. When your son tries to get a job with the U.S. government, he may be turned down. You're not going to be told why. It happens because that name happens to go in the computer, and it's there forever, and there's no way to remove it. So those are some of the things I think people have to really worry about.
And now biometric information on your passport.
Right, and it just gets worse and worse.
What are they? What do we know about what they're putting on passports? Coding.
Well,
what are they coding?
I don't know. That's an area that is really worth looking into, but it's not an area that I've followed very closely. But the irony here is that the center for all this biometrics that the government is involved in is at NSA. That's NSA's job. NSA has. I've actually been through their facility there, where they create all the biometrics. That's one of NSA's responsibilities. So that's why all these things need to be very closely followed. And today, you know, you put all your most personal information in emails. You talk constantly on cell phones. Make appointments on Blackberries. Use Wi-Fi hotspots to do work on computers. And all this stuff is so very vulnerable. And if the government wants... If there's no regulation, if there's no firewall between NSA and the American public, and that's the only thing that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court was, and you take that away, then there's, you know, you're entering the era that George Orwell wrote about, 1984.
I was just struck when you said firewall, because I was going to ask you, is there any way to stifle NSA? And, of course, there isn't really a firewall, but... Harrison Ford's coming out with a new movie called Firewall, and that may give us the answer, huh?
Well, it's good timing for the movie, that's for sure.
Hey, anything else, Eddie or James Bamford?
Thank you very much, Jim. I really appreciate you coming on with us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my pleasure. It was good being on with both of you, and very good questions, so thanks again.
Thank you so much. How's the weather in Washington, D.C. this morning?
Oh, it was nice. It was. We got almost up to 70 yesterday.
Wow.
I think it's just an incredible global... warming effect. We've had very mild winters the last few years, mm-hmm. and yesterday, people were out in short-sleeve shirts and everything.
One quick final question. Eddie and I, who have both lived in Washington, D.C., were wondering, what was the restaurant where Tenet had breakfast with, I think it was Bourne?
Well, it was the restaurant of the
that breakfast?
St. Moritz Hotel.
The
uh-huh.
St. Moritz? Oh, okay.
So yeah. It's nobody goes to the Palm anymore, or...
Well, none of these events took place in the Palm. I mean, a lot of journalists like to meet their sources in the Palm for some reason, especially uh-huh. in the Bush administration. It's a very sort of Republican kind of a place. But this is probably one of the fanciest places in Washington to have breakfast, was the dining room of the St. Moritz Hotel.
Mm-hmm. Where do the Democrats hang out?
I'm not sure, you know.
mm-hmm. They just go home.
They probably just get a cup of coffee down on the machine or something.
I guess that kind of sums it up. Hey, James Bamford, you're wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for writing these books, Pretext for War, The Puzzle Palace, and the third, Remind Me, Body of Secrets. I want everybody to go out and get a Pretext for War. This is just the most amazing journey into the day 9/11. I want to thank you for the work that you do putting this together, and I hope that you continue to be safe and that life is good for you.
Well, thanks. Thanks again for having me on. It's great to have terrific questions, and I appreciate you doing hard work and coming up with good questions.
Thanks very much. We appreciate you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, if they freed me from this prison, if that railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line. Far from Folsom Prison, that's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
Yeah, Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison. I think I have Peter Emerson on the line. Peter, you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. And it sounds like the cafe's busy in the background.
Yes, it is.
Great. Let me just tell my listeners, I've had a long-term fantasy about a special kind of cafe where people could buy and read various newspapers, magazines, etc., and where you could get homemade real food served by real good-hearted, hard-working women and men, where there's an interesting, eclectic music world that would add to but never detract from conversation, and where politics would be an undercurrent running through the place. And I have to say, Peter, I found it at Southeast Stark and 79th, and to be precise, it's called the Bipartisan Cafe, and you are the owner, and I want to thank you for making it happen.
Oh, actually, it was my pleasure.
Peter, tell us a little bit about your background and how the Bipartisan Cafe came into being.
I can't even remember when the name came to me. The name came to me first, and it probably had something to do with the idea that I never met anybody who didn't agree with me. So if I sat and talked about what I believe politically, I was always just preaching to the choir. And I come from a small town in Minnesota, and in small towns, everybody meets at the same cafe. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor or a farmer, Democrat, Republican, whatever. So at some point, I just said in a conversation, we need a bipartisan cafe. And that was probably over 10 years ago. And then I began working in coffee. I worked for Starbucks for 10 years. And the idea was just kind of in my head, evolving over time. And finally, it's come. Here it is.
So tell us a little bit about the cafe itself. One of the first things that struck me when I went in, of course, was the big open space, the big windows, and in a community that I wouldn't normally have expected to find this kind of cafe. What about your demographic?
Well, I feel like I got really lucky because I found exactly what I was looking for. We have everyone here from, we have lots of young families with 2 and 3 year olds who come in, and the kids love the place because it is big and open, and we have toys there for them. And we also have senior citizens and everything in between, lots of college kids. We have working class people. We have people who are well-to-do and retired. Everybody meets here.
And another thing that struck me, of course, was the homemade pies. Tell us about the pies. What's available today if I come in?
Today we have, I believe, peach Marionberry, apple, and chocolate cream.
Mm-hmm.
But that can change pretty quickly.
And you make everything on site?
We make all the pies. We make the carrot cake. We make the banana bread. We make the quiche, and we make the soup. We do get pastries from La Provence brought in.
I have to commend you because getting fresh homemade pie anywhere anymore is a pretty remote possibility, so thank you for the pie. And I also love the fact that you heat up the mugs for coffee before you hand them to us, so that's a pretty nice piece. I also want to talk about the artifacts because that's also a pretty stunning thing. One of them is an old-fashioned voting booth.
That actually is a year 2000 Palm Beach County voting booth.
Okay, so that's where'd you get it?
I got it on eBay.
And you also have pictures of all sorts of people hanging up. There's Kennedy, Johnson, Eisenhower, Taft, just a few that I noted down, Calvin Coolidge, Truman Roosevelt, McKinley, Herbert Hoover.
My plan is to have every president and also to branch out into people who aren't presidents, because unfortunately, if you have every president, you're going to have a bunch of old white people up there, old white men.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to find good, interesting things. Now that I'm on the air, I'll say if anybody has a good, interesting thing of a favorite politician, give me a call.
Mm-hmm.
especially if it's not necessarily a president.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually some of, you know, if you want a African-American or Chinese leader or whatever, it's not traditional, it's actually a little harder to find.
And that, of course, would be by just going down to 79th and Southeast Stark, where you actually have the Bipartisan Cafe. You had an election night gathering this year. How did that go?
Actually, it was the State of the Union gathering.
State of the Union.
We actually got on it kind of late as far as advertising it, but we had probably 8 or 10 people here and sat and watched it, and it was interesting. We had one couple from Mississippi who came down there, and they actually had lost everything in Katrina, and they were listening for one thing and reacted rather strongly when they didn't hear what they wanted to hear. So
we need to get C-SPAN down there to monitor your group as one of the election night groups, huh?
I would love it. I've been open about 8 months, and I've spent this time getting the restaurant up and running, and now I want to get more stuff like that. I hope for this election that I will have people who think of us when they want to find out what's going on in an election. We're also having a meet and greet by one of the local politicians here on, I think we decided on the 23rd of April.
Is the conversation actually bipartisan now, Peter?
Well, you know, I actually, unfortunately, I don't get to be in much of the conversation. So my assumption is that everybody's welcome, and I hope that people who come in, if they have differing ideas, are able to speak civilly and hear each other. And you know, it's a pretty strong Democratic area, but you know, we get all kinds in here, and I've had a few conversations with people who want to express a different opinion, and that's what we're looking for.
Well, anybody would certainly feel welcome, no matter what the persuasion, because the artwork on the walls, the photographs, would give anybody a feeling of comfort, because there's something for everyone to identify with.
Yes. Everybody, the way I look at it is there's a lot of heroes and villains up there, but it's not the same for everybody.
Mm-hmm. You're also a Wi-Fi center, and we were just talking to James Bamford, who's a kind of an expert and has written extensively on the National Security Agency. But nonetheless, people are able to go into various places, and yours is one of them where they can hook up, right?
Yes.
And let's see, what else? You've got a book stall with books that people can read. And there's a new theater going up across the street, so it makes me think that it's kind of a renaissance in that neighborhood, which is what, Montevilla?
Montevilla neighborhood, yeah. I feel like I've been front row seat to watching this neighborhood turn around, and it's been great. Everybody's really excited about the Academy Theater opening across the street. It's going to have 3 screens, and I believe I better not give a date because I know that's really floating around there, but it's very soon, probably within a month, it's going to be open, and they're going to make it look like it did opening night 1947.
All right. So, Peter, is there anything else you'd like to talk about the cafe, the Bipartisan Cafe on 79th and Southeast Stark, that I may not have asked you about that you'd like our listeners to know about?
I'm starting to have music on a fairly regular basis. We have some Irish musicians who come and play on Saturday nights at 7. We're having some Americana music on, hopefully I'm going to set that up for Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
We have a piano here. We have several people who just come in and play piano.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And if people wanted to play, they could just contact you, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to thank you so much, Peter, for talking to us. What's the soup today, by the way?
Soup today is clam chowder and beef chili.
All right, okay. Well, I'm a real fan of everything that you are doing in that cafe, and I love the pies. I love the carrot cake. I'm real fond of the soup, and I like the sandwiches. So I have to thank you, and I especially love the warmed mugs for my coffee.
All right.
Peter, thanks. Tell everybody to have a good day, and I appreciate the few minutes you were able to give us in the middle of what I know is your busy time.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Peter Emerson, the Bipartisan Cafe, worth checking out on 79th and Southeast Stark. Big old space, really community-based, kind of down home, and in spite of the Wi-Fi and the NSA listening, which you'll get anywhere, everything else about it is just worth being there. I think I'm going to take a little musical break because I got some more Johnny Cash to play, and then we'll come back and do Dave.
On a Monday, I was arrested. On a Tuesday, they locked me in the jail. On a Wednesday, my trial was attested. On a Thursday, they said guilty, and the judge's gavel fell. I got stripes, stripes around my shoulders. I got chains, chains around my feet. I got stripes, stripes around my shoulders. And them chains, they're about to drag us down.
On a Monday, I got my striped breeches. And on a Tuesday, I got my ball and chain. And on a Wednesday, I'm a working digging ditches. And on a Thursday, John, I beg them not to knock me down again.
I got stripes, stripes around my shoulders. I got chains, chains around my feet. I got stripes, stripes around my shoulders. And them chains, they're about to drag us down. On a Monday, my mama come to see me. On a Tuesday, they caught me with a file.
On a Wednesday, I'm down in solitary. And on a Thursday, John, I starved on bread and water for a while.
I got stripes. Stripes around my shoulders. I got chains, chains around my feet. I got stripes, stripes around my shoulders. And them chains, they're about to drag us down.
Johnny Cash, I Got Stripes. I'm Marlena Smith. It's 26 minutes after the hour of 10. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO, in Portland. Quick announcements, and then we'll go right over to Dave Emery. Pete Sorensen is going to be running for governor. He wants to challenge Ted Kulongowski, and Multnomah County Democrats will have an endorsement meeting this Saturday from 2 to 4 for statewide candidates at PSU Smith Center, room 327 and 329. Pete Sorensen and Jim Hall will be there. So Pete Sorensen's a good enough guy. If you're interested in having a little variety in the Democratic Party, this might be the way to go. See, I also have a real nice letter from Keith Jones. Keith, thank you so much for that lovely note that you sent and for this beautiful piece of poetry that came with a lovely image on the front of the card. I don't really have time to read it, but I love it, and it goes in my sacred box. Here's something called Corazon d'Amour at the Wonder Ballroom tonight from 8 to 2:30 at 128 Northeast Russell. Lots of good stuff going on there. Nice little card with the Cupid heart. Calendar announcement here, War Tax Resistance and Redirection Workshop on Monday, the 20th at 7 p.m., Laughing Horse Books, 3652 Southeast Division, hosted by War Resisters League, Portland Chapter. If you're opposed to war, why pay for it? And that, boy, there's a question. And then here's a big one from old KABU, celebrating multicultural activities right down here at KABU with special programming and a potluck-style open house tomorrow. Tune in from noon to 9 for special programming on the air. Join us for a potluck open house from 1 to 6. Bring food from your own cultural heritage to share with others as we celebrate this day together. And there's all sorts of good stuff going on, Latino, Asian, Native American, roundtable discussions, Iranian community, African American. You've got the picture right here on your radio station tomorrow. So come on down and bring some food that's particular for your people and share it with our people, and everybody, all the people will be happy. Okay, now, Dave Emery, this is the one I wanted to run last week and held till this week because it's more political. Dave has gotten it together to compile a lot of old anti-fascist texts that a lot of younger people may not be aware of, and he's put them on the Spitfire website so that people can download them for free and preserve some of this history. So I'm pretty excited about this. I think it was a great idea for Dave to do this, and let's see if I can make all the magic work. Okay, and that's not working here. Okay, something is not working with my technology, so I'll give you some more Johnny Cash.
When I was a curly-headed baby, my daddy set me down upon his knee. He said, boy, you go to school and learn your letters. Don't you be a dirty miner like me. I was born and raised in the mouth of a hazard hollow. Coal cars rambled past my door.
Okay, say goodbye to Johnny Cash. Say hello to Dave Emery.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 539, titled Beneath the Covers. This is being recorded on January 29th of the year 2006. This is the first originally recorded program of the new year, 2006, obviously. So let me first of all wish all of you out there a happy new year and a productive new year. Let me also begin this year by charging the people who listen to the program and who value the material with a task. Some of you are already doing a very good job with this task, and what I'd like to do is to encourage all of you to do what you reasonably can to further that task. That task is getting the word out. That task is using the growing and already enormous amount of material on the Spitfire website, both audio material and printed material, and the material on the linked websites, both audio and printed, and disseminate the information via the internet, blogs, talk shows, chat groups, whatever mediated communication is available to you. I want to really, really strongly encourage members of the listening audience to take advantage of the communications that are available to us, the internet, talk shows, and such, some the various technologies of that type, and use the information on the website. Now, as regular listeners are probably aware, I have taken a short hiatus from original production. That is because I have been engaged in a writing project. We now have a number of wonderful old anti-fascist books, books that are now more than 50 years old, and they are up and available on the Spitfire website, and they are available for free. This is a remarkable, well, it's really something of a library in and of itself. I began to realize as, well, I didn't begin to realize, I realized as I was sort of plunging forward through the research that I've been doing on September 11th and related subject material, that to a significant percentage of the audience, a lot of the things that I was talking about, in particular my discussion of a fifth column in the United States that aided the attacks, this might not mean a great deal to members of the audience, and that's in no way a finding of fault. I've been described in many ways by many people, but I describe myself as an anti-fascist. I've undertaken, it became clear to me early on in my adult life that some things were going dreadfully wrong. That perception began really in a fundamental way with my study of the assassination of President Kennedy. I've done what I could over the years to use media, both printed and audio, to communicate as much vital information to the audience as I could. As I said, during the course, over the years of the September 11th investigations, I began to realize that an awful lot of what I was talking about probably did not make a lot of sense to people, simply because the methodology and substantive history of fascism was really not something that most people had achieved a familiarity with. So, in order to help bridge that gap, We have put a number of remarkable books. A listener back east boiled these books down into some really compact Adobe PDF files. They are easily downloaded. You can download them to your computer very quickly and then print them up, have them bound in a cheap binding, and you got the books. But what I've been doing for the last month or so is polishing off a project that I didn't think was going to take this much time, but then any time Dave Emery sits down to begin producing words, whether orally or in print, things tend to sort of snowball and roll downhill. So not surprisingly, the project turned out to be considerably longer than I had anticipated. I've written a fairly good-sized introduction and overview of the various books that are available on the Spitfire website, and also three that are going to be available but are not available yet. I've also written introductions to each of the books that is already up there. And what I'm going to do in this program is to read some of what I have been concentrating on. From this point forward, I will be producing new programs each week, but or almost each week. There may be some times when I take a break for other professional reasons. But I thought that by way of easing into the new year, and by way of also providing some emphatic encouragement to members of the audience to use the material available on the Spitfire website and related websites to get the word out. And what I'm going to do, this is sort of an experimental format for a program, but what I'm going to do is read not only the introduction to the books, but some of the introductions, some of the summaries and reviews of the various books. And by way of launching a new year, by way of christening, so to speak, an effort on the part of the audience to do as much as possible, not just this year, but every year to get the word out, I thought we'd take a look at the past and through coming to understand the past, understand the present better, and through coming to understand the present better, hopefully we will be able to deal with the future in a more effective fashion. We're going to begin. I'm going to read the introduction to the books in its entirety. And again, if you just tuned in, if you're a regular listener, one of the reasons, the reason I haven't been producing new shows, and I will be doing that from this point forward, I've been engaged in a writing project, not only writing an introduction to the old anti-fascist books now available for free on the Spitfire website, but a description and review of each book. The general introduction begins with a joke that made the rounds in the early 1980s. If there are listeners out there who are saying, oh, there goes Dave again, you know, that old stuff, it's old, it doesn't matter anymore. Well, William Faulkner observed, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. The introduction begins with a joke that made the rounds in the early 1980s. It's a good thing we didn't lose World War II. If we had, all our public officials would be named Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, and everybody be driving Japanese and German cars. Of course, we're all very glad that didn't happen, right? Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, of course, a reference to George Schultz, Cap Weinberger, and Henry Kissinger, who were major political luminaries in the Nixon, Ford, and Reagan administrations. Now, for younger listeners, those names might not be as clear and significant as they were for the older listeners. The main body of the introduction itself reads, in the decades since the end of the Second World War, much has been written about the war and fascism, the driving force behind the aggression that precipitated that conflict. Unfortunately, much of what has been said and written has failed to identify and analyze the causes, nature, and methodology of fascism, German National Socialism, or Nazism in particular. A deeper, more accurate analysis was presented in literature published before, during, and immediately after World War II. The Spitfire website is pleased to present a number of books published during that period. All more than 50 years old, these works embody a more complete, profound analysis of the historical forces that dominated the events of that time and, more importantly, our own. Whereas much contemporary literature on the subject presents fascism and Nazism in particular as an aberration, the phenomenon was an outgrowth of major political forces and dynamics that dominate and control contemporary events and processes. Some of the books presented here illustrate the extent to which fascism, Nazism in particular, was an outgrowth of globalization and the construction of international monopolies or cartels. For the record shows 99, 361, 426, 511, and 532 present an overview of the reinvestment of the wealth generated by the American industrial boom of the 1920s in Japanese and German strategic heavy industry. It was this capital that drove the engines of conquest that subdued both Europe and Asia during the conflict. Germany's Master Plan, 1943, by Borken and Welch, analyzes how the Nazis took advantage of the budding globalized economy to restrict their enemies' strategic production as well as their access to critical raw materials. Treason's Peace, 1947, by Howard Watson Ombruster, highlights how the IG Farben chemical firm manipulated trade relationships to the advantage of the Third Reich. In addition, the book illustrates how corporations, businessmen, and politicians beholden under the firm's non-German cartel partners assisted that manipulation, as well as the post-war rehabilitation and exoneration of both IG and its most important personnel. Those personnel and the vast reach of IG Farben and its cartel partners are also the subject of Josiah Du Bois's The Devil's Chemists. James Stewart Martin's All Honorable Men of 1950, by the way, I neglected to put in here that The Devil's Chemist is from 1952. James Stewart Martin's All Honorable Men documents the manner in which powerful economic interests in the United States frustrated attempts at decartelization and thereby ensured the post-war perpetuation of globalized business as usual, unquote. As Martin points out, these commercial interests were able to successfully manipulate the networks through which government operates and directed to their own nefarious ends. The lone title in the collection, less than 50 years old, Paul Manning's Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile from 1981, chronicles the post-war underground perpetuation of the Nazi political and business hierarchy and its dominant role in both the international corporate economy and the contemporary political landscape. The Third Reich's elaborate plans for post-war underground survival and continuity were predicated on the certainty that the multinational corporate community would preserve the Nazi infrastructure as a bulwark against communism during the then-imminent Cold War. The Underground Reich was foreseen and analyzed in Kurt Riess's The Nazis Go Underground, published in early 1944. In addition to the powerful corporate economic interests allied with Nazi business centers, the process of underground perpetuation was greatly aided by the Fifth Column movements abroad. Composed of ideological supporters of the fascist philosophy, these Fifth Column movements were instrumental in realizing Nazi blueprints for military conquest during the war, as well as post-war continuation and enlargement of those plans. Written on the eve of World War II, Joseph Gollum's Army of Spies correctly anticipated the enormous scope and effectively successful activities of the Fifth Columnists in nations slated for Nazi invasion. Triumph of Treason, 1944, by Pierre Coe, is a remarkable first-hand account of the subversion of France by powerful domestic interests who saw political control by their ideological allies and cartel business partners in Germany as preferable to power sharing with their own democratically minded citizens. Coe had been the French Minister of Aviation in the immediate pre-war period and witnessed the deliberate success of the domination of several continents, Europe, North Africa, and Latin America. The Nazis and their allies in the General Staff groomed the Spanish Falange as the fascist movement of choice. Writing of this in 1943, Alan Chase notes how the Reich then used political control of Spain to advance their agenda in Latin America and the Spanish-speaking world. The reader is invited to address Chase's research in light of the relatively well-documented post-war operation and perpetuation of fascist interests in Latin America. For the Nazis, geopolitics dictated a profound interest in the Muslim peoples of what they called the Earth Island, a giant, contiguous landmass that encompasses all of Europe, much of the Middle East, then the former Soviet Union, India, including Pakistan at the time, and China. Stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar to the Pacific coasts of China and Russia, this landmass contains most of the world's territory, population, and natural resources, oil in particular. Control that land, and you control the world. Accordingly, The Nazis built alliances with the various Muslim populations, Arabs in particular, that are indigenous to many of the most important petroleum-producing regions. Writing in 1951, John Roy Carlson witnessed and chronicled the post-war Nazi recrudescence in the Middle East in Cairo to Damascus, a work that has particular importance for students of the events of 9/11/2001. In an earlier work, Undercover, from 1943, Carlson infiltrated and wrote about the vigorous Axis underground that existed in the United States before and during. Albert E. Kahn penned Sabotage in 1940. This nature of many of the American Fifth columnists who committed acts of assassination and sabotage in support of the Axis powers. These tactics were used to good effect in Germany and Japan, where potential political opponents to the rise of fascism were eliminated through a deliberate program of political murder. It is in that context that we may view Government by Assassination from 1942, Hugh Bias's riveting account of the assassinations committed by the Japanese Patriotic and Ultranationalist Societies. Culminating in the May 15th incident, the assassination of the Japanese Prime Minister on May 15th, 1932, these murders were instrumental in the accession to power of the Japanese militarists and the corporate and imperial elements behind them. Two other books available here provide valuable insights into the contemporary period. T.H. Tetten's Germany Plots with the Kremlin from 1953 treats the pivotally important German Ostpolitik, which German power structure has traditionally exploited in order to expand and develop its influence. The German threat to either remain neutral during the Cold War or to ally with the USSR was a significant factor in persuading conservative American power brokers to go along with the return to power in Germany of the very Nazi elements that prosecuted World War II. Under the circumstances, some of these conservatives felt that permitting Nazi elements to return to power behind a democratic facade was the lesser of two evils, although many would have preferred a more traditionally conservative German political establishment. This German Ostpolitik, in turn, is characteristic of the geopolitical foresight and cynicism with which pan-Germanists have successfully pursued their goal of world domination through the centuries. Paul Winkler's The Thousand-Year Conspiracy from 1943 traces the origins of German chauvinism to the ascent of the Teutonic Knights within Germanic society. Winkler labels the enablers of the dark side of the German character Prusso-Teutonics, unquote, and notes that, in their pursuit of pan-German goals, they do not hesitate to deal in a cynical and ruthless manner with their own citizens. Of particular note for contemporary Americans is the deliberate Machiavellian manipulation of the German economy by Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, the American-born financier who eventually became the finance minister of the Third Reich. Take note of Winkler's account of how Schacht restructured the German economy with an eye to, among other things, driving the citizenry to such a point of hysteria that they would willingly follow the likes of Hitler. Compare Winkler's analysis with what is taking place today in the United States. Writing in 1943, Winkler foresaw that the Prusso-Teutonics would realize their goals through the creation of a German-dominated Central European Economic Union bearing a striking resemblance to today's European Monetary Union. And that introduction closes with a couple of quotes. One is a famous quote, "Those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it," by philosopher George Santayana, and also a quote from the introduction to Borkin and Welsh's Germany's Master Plan, The Story of an Industrial Offensive. That book, by the way, published in 1943. Joseph Borkin was also the author of the 1979 book, The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. In the introduction to Germany's Master Plan from 1943, then U.S. Attorney General Thurman W. Arnold wrote, quote, "We cannot turn over our future economic policy to private groups without public responsibility as we have in the past," unquote. Ha! Boy, doesn't that look strange and bitterly ironic in light of everything that's happened since, privatization being the order of the day. Now, again, these books are an invaluable research source, and I'm going to read some or all of some of the book introductions by way of not only providing the audio listening audience with some initial familiarity with these volumes, but also to underscore some points that perhaps could stand with some underscoring in connection in particular with my analysis of contemporary events, the events in and around September 11th in particular. From the description that I wrote about Germany's master plan, The Story of an Industrial Offensive by Joseph Borken and Charles A. Welch from 1943, we read, Germany's master plan, 1943, by Borken and Welch, analyzes how the Nazis took advantage of the budding globalized economy to restrict both their enemies' strategic production and their access to critical raw materials. The same cartel agreements gave the German war economy access to technological know-how and raw materials vital to the successful prosecution of modern defeat from World War I. The German military-industrial complex also sought to use technological innovation to make up for key areas of shortfall. Utilizing leading-edge technology to great advantage, companies such as IG Farben developed processes to synthesize oil, rubber, narcotics to treat casualties, and other innovations that greatly aided the German wartime economy. I can appreciate that for many listeners, when I talk about the Underground Reich, that just must sound particularly crazy. Well, remember that the Mafia began as a resistance movement in 12th and 13th century Sicily to Norse and Saracen invaders, basically Vikings and Turks. Well, the Vikings and the Turks are long gone from Sicily. The 12th and 13th centuries a long time ago, but the Mafia is still very much present in Sicily, and it's not just present there, it's present in the United States as well. Every Sunday night about 9 o'clock, a nice segment of the American television viewing audience tunes into a melodrama, The Sopranos, about an organization that's very real, very present in the United States, but that began in the 12th and 13th century in Sicily as a resistance movement to Viking and Saracen invaders. The point is, underground political movements can be perpetuated. Another thing to understand, in addition to the cartels, which had much to do with preserving the economic power that powered the Reich, one must also understand the philosophy of Karl von Clausewitz, the Prussian military philosopher. If listeners use the search function on the Spitfire website there, the von Clausewitz is mentioned in a number of programs. But in this introduction to Germany's master plan from 1943, an understanding of the philosophy of Karl von Clausewitz is key, and it's set forth here in the description. Reading. Key to the German industrial offensive was the doctrine of the famous Prussian military philosopher Karl von Clausewitz, the first strategic thinker to formalize the concept of total war. On pages, marketplace. Globalization was well underway in the early part of the 20th century. It was one of the things that created the economic power that the Nazis and the Japanese used to conquer Europe and Asia, respectively. Globalization has continued, but whereas American corporations continue to basically be apatriotic, to coin a term, they will readily sell out to a foreign competitor and sell out the country's interests in so doing, the German corporations function like the units of an army. Use the Spitfire website and look up Vodafone, V-O-D-A-P-H-O-N-E, V-O-D-A-P-H-O-N-E, and Monesmon, M-A-N-N-E-S-M-A-N-N. That is the only hostile takeover of a major German corporation in history. Monesmon is one of the German core corporations. Originally a heavy industrial firm, it branched out into telecommunications. When the British-owned Vodafone tried to basically effect a hostile takeover of Monesmon, the other major German corporations and banks rallied around rather like a school of porpoises or dolphins rallying around a stricken member of their herd or pod. That's very different from the way American corporations behave. Just take a look, for example, at the old Chrysler Corporation. Now it's Daimler Chrysler. And there's a joke. How do you pronounce Daimler Chrysler in German? Daimler. The Chrysler is silent. That firm, by the way, was in deep trouble in 1980. It was bailed out with a huge U.S. taxpayer subsidy. But nonetheless, when the time came, it was readily gobbled up. That is in sharp contrast with the way the German corporations behave. And we're going to continue with our look at the past by way of shoring up our understanding of the present. And in particular, we're going to take a look at fifth column movements and how they're used, because I think in understanding the Muslim Brotherhood's infiltration of the United States, in understanding the SAR network, the Safa Trust, Bank al-Taqwa, and many of the things that lie at the foundation of our inquiry into September 11th, I think an understanding of fascist fifth column methodology is important. And we're going to continue with all of this inside, too. Please, again, do everything you can to distribute information from the Spitfire website and related websites. There's a wealth of it. It's growing. In addition to the books and the introductions that I've written, there's a link to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU featuring the entire For the Record broadcast for download for free on Real Audio and MP3. WFMU is also podcasting the For the Record programs. Listeners in the Midwest have put together a website with the declassified government documents proving the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II, subject we're going to touch on inside, too. There's a search function on the Spitfire website. There are lectures available for download. There are the more recent For the Record shows on the Spitfire website as well. Long article-length descriptions of the various programs that I've done. So please take advantage of the Spitfire website. It is an enormous resource. Oh, by the way, and last but certainly not least, there is a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you value this information, there's no better way of supporting what I'm, of getting the word out than supporting what I'm doing. But please, as we move into the new year, as we begin again, let's do what we can to utilize this website, get the information out, and basically maintain a steady pace of cranking it out there. Don't be discouraged if people don't respond right away, or if you don't ever get a tangible response. That doesn't mean you're not being effective.
And that's it for Dave Emery this morning. I'm Marlena Smith. I want to thank you for listening. It's 2 minutes before the hour of 11. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 right here in Portland. We will continue next week with more Dave Emery, or not next week, the next time I'm back in March. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, we'll look at the Australian report that broke the story of more photographs and videos of Iraqi detainees being tortured inside Abu Ghraib. And Professor Alfred McCoy talks about his book, A Question of Torture, a startling expose of the CIA's development of psychological torture from the Cold War to Abu Ghraib. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Children's Theater presenting the world premiere of The Giver, the story of a boy learning of the tragic sacrifices his community has made for safety and security. The Giver runs March 5, 11, and 12 at 2 p.m. at Keller Auditorium, 222 Southwest Clay. Tickets at 503-228-9571 or Ticketmaster.com. Appropriate for ages 10 and up. Information about The Giver at octc.org. Okay, let's go out with a little Johnny Cash.
Early one morning while making the rounds, took a shot of cocaine and I shot my woman down. Went right home and went to bed. I stuck at loving 44 beneath my head. Got up next morning and I grabbed that gun. Took a shot of cocaine and away I run. Made a good run, but a run too slow. They overtook me down in Juarez, Mexico. Laid in the hop joints, taking the pill. In walked the sheriff from Jericho Hill. He said, Willie Lee, your name is not Jack Brown. You're the dirty hop that shot your woman down.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Many of the new photos show Lindy England and Charles Grainer having sex. But more disturbingly, the new photos and videos apparently reveal more torture, sexual humiliation, and killings.